Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth, straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden, and I'm working
at... An Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents, for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Hi, welcome to the Chuck and Julie Show. Chuck and Julie are out watching their kid play golf, which is always an awesome thing to do. I used to watch my boys play baseball in high school, and I loved going to their games and watching them play. I appreciate them letting me guest host this afternoon. Always love to do it from time to time to talk about current cases. So I'm Mark Poff, your guest host for the day, retired detective from the El Paso County Sheriff's Office down in Colorado Springs, worked on numerous homicide and other cases. John St. Augustine will be joining me at a quarter after, and we're going to talk about Nancy Guthrie and this whole fiasco down in Tucson and how that case is working out. Obviously not very well, but we're going to talk about that a little bit. And so I just need to fill in for the next 15 minutes before we talk about our old cop stuff and detectives and investigator stuff. So I always like to talk about current events. I always joke with Julie whenever she sends me a text or an email saying, hey, do you mind guest hosting? I always like, you know what that means. Something big's going to happen. Well, not really anything real big happened today, but I got to say, Plattner from Maine is just hilarious. I love these things. I consider this stuff to be entertaining. I consider the people who vote for this moron or this idiot, my opinion, just incredible. It shows to what lengths people will go to for their agenda. If somebody was that disqualified or not qualified to be a senator from Maine, this is the guy that is it. He's the gift that just keeps giving to the Republican Party. This should have been their chance to win the Senate of any time, and they just screwed the whole thing up. Now, I'm looking at the current events. I actually have them up here on the screen. He's kind of gone undercover here for the week because they said that next Monday is the last day that the Democrat Party can throw a name in the hat. If he resigns, they can just, it almost sounds like the old presidential election where they're just going to throw a name in there. Talk about a lack of democracy in anything. Are they going to pick the next highest number of votes of the senator that, you know, or are they still going to go with him? He'd just been accused of a sex assault 5 years ago. Sounds like it's pretty graphic. When you actually read the article, she says, you know, I had mixed feelings about saying anything because I agree with his agenda. Well, that's absolutely not how it should work. As a retired cop, I pulled over Democrats and I pulled over Republicans. I've probably pulled over independents for speeding. I don't sit there and say, driver, you know, I'd like to see your driver's license, registration, proof of insurance, and your voter registration card. I don't care who they are. They're speeding. They need a ticket. Plattner is a moron. He's an idiot. He's a racist. He's all these words they keep trying to throw at Republicans. This guy's it. I mean, he's truly a Nazi. And they're trying to call everybody else a Nazi, but yet they still make him their nominee for Maine. I mean, that's just amazing to me. Well, she should have had no hesitation just because he happened to be a Democrat like her, and the things he's saying matches her agenda. That should be irrelevant. It's like, no, this guy's got to go. And it'll be interesting to see what actually happens. If he can garnish or continue to garnish support for him running for Senate, everybody should be abandoning him at this point. You know, the Republicans don't seem to have a big issue about knocking out bad Republicans and getting rid of them. But the Democrats just, they're so focused on Trump and how much they hate Trump and how much they you know, talk about the ultimate, the means justifies, or yeah, the means justifies the ends. This is it. This guy has no business. His campaign never should have even got off the ground, let alone get to this point and get the nomination. I mean, how could any person with any integrity ever cast a vote for that person? I mean, at worst, for me, if there's a Republican and a Democrat and I just can't vote for the Republican, I'm just not going to vote. I'll just not vote. And then I don't have to say that, well, I had to vote for the other guy. No, you don't have to vote for the other guy. You just don't vote for this person. And your conscience is clear that, hey, I didn't vote for that person. I don't support that person. And I would be outspoken, that I don't support this person. But, and this is not going to end. Like I said, the gift that just keeps on giving. If he refuses, if his own arrogance, doesn't allow him to drop out of the race by next Monday. I mean, he needs to drop out now to give the Democrats a chance. I mean, there's nothing they can do. I mean, the only thing they could do with integrity is give it to the next person who had the next number of votes, whoever that person is. But we'll see what happens. Kamala Harris will probably register in Maine now or something and try to get that Senate seat. Who knows? But this is the same kind of stuff. When they just threw Kamala Harris in, instead of opening it up, and having some kind of mini primary or something at their the convention, they walked away from democracy and put their own person in. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to Plattner. I saw something really interesting today about Jasmine Crockett. She's amazing. She's the only lawyer. I mean, supposedly she's a lawyer. I can't believe that because she's an idiot too, my opinion. She made a statement on a podcast, a video podcast, about the kid who stabbed the other one in Texas and killed him. That when they were talking about this knife and said, this was just a little knife. This wasn't a big, huge knife. And she said, well, that doesn't even sound like a deadly weapon. Well, that's about the stupidest statement she could say. I teach the law at Pikes Peak College. And let me tell you what the definition of a deadly weapon is: any weapon that can cause death. So obviously, if the kid used this knife, however big or small it was, if it killed someone, obviously it's a deadly weapon. But here she is saying, well, that doesn't even sound like a deadly weapon. She's an idiot. And again, it'll be good to see her go bye-bye. I'm just not sure that's going to happen. She's probably going to come back. But she keeps me entertained with her stupid statements. I love these stupid statements. But one of the things I did want to talk about, I just got to fill about 8 more minutes and then John will jump on, is activist judges. I have to deal with a lot of judges. So I was a detective. I was in law enforcement for 17 years as a cop. 10 of those years, I was a detective specializing in high-tech crimes, worked on over 80 homicides, all kinds of cool stuff. Best job I've ever had. But I retired about 12 years ago, and I've been a consultant ever since, working predominantly for defense attorneys. So I've seen the other side of this story. And John and I constantly talk about these cases where we have to deal with things that we just can't believe. And here recently, I had a case that just got resolved where the cop showed a picture to an eyewitness who was an eyewitness to a homicide. And 3 years earlier in an interview, she said, I never saw the guy's face. I think that should be pretty clear. 3 years later, a detective brings her back into the interview room, shows her a picture, single picture, one person, not six, not a lineup, not a photo array. And it's a surveillance picture, not even very good quality, and says, does that kind of look like him? She goes, well, yeah, kind of. And he puts in his affidavit when he arrests this guy that she made a positive ID. That's not how law enforcement works. In fact, that should get you fired. You're supposed to, there's standards that we talk about, best practices. You got to have six pictures. They've got to pick them out. But when she said 2 hours after the homicide, I never saw his face, and you bring her back in 3 years later, and she goes, well, I guess that kind of looks like him. And then you say in your warrant that she made a positive ID. That's not good cop work and stuff. And we see all kinds of things like this. And we try to keep the integrity. We're all about the integrity in the system to make sure the system is fair for all that are accused. And I've really had a good time in the last 10, 12 years working, like I said, predominantly for defense attorneys. Occasionally DAs will hire me, but they're not doing it now because they really don't like me anymore. But judges are an interesting point. Judges have absolute immunity, and so do district attorneys, but I mean, judges have absolute immunity. So I always took an interesting point in Judge Dugan up in Milwaukee when she thwarted the law and basically led law enforcement in the courtroom, in the courthouse, led law enforcement who were looking for an illegal alien that they wanted to take into custody that was in her courtroom. She led them the other way and then helped sneak the guy out the back of the courthouse. Now, ultimately, they got him, everything worked out and stuff, but she felt above the law. She felt, I have absolute immunity. And she used that when they charged her. She said, no, I've got absolute immunity. And they said, no, you don't. Not on something like this. And that's why we have to be really careful about judges having absolute immunity. Definitely district attorneys, they should get rid of it. It should be qualified immunity, the same as law enforcement. You can't have district attorneys doing whatever they want. I've definitely seen DAs out of control where they've gone after political rivals and enemies. The Terry Makita case down in El Paso County is absolutely probably one of the best examples of that in the state of Colorado in a local case. Here's a sheriff. He was a great sheriff. I worked for him. He really loved his people, took care of his people, was all about law enforcement and integrity. He pissed off the local DA. They went after him. I reviewed everything in this case. Terry Makita never committed a crime, not even close, but they stretched the truth, to incredible levels. And if you've ever heard the statement that you can indict a ham sandwich through a grand jury, that is absolutely correct. He never committed a crime. That was all politically motivated by the current DA and his cronies. But so Judge Dugan did this. She went to trial. I thought it was amazing she went to trial. I thought for sure there would be a deal cut. She was convicted of obstruction, and she's now looking at a maximum of 5 years in federal prison. I still can't believe she's going to be going to prison. She gets sentenced this Wednesday, so I'm really interested. I have this. I find this very entertaining, very interesting would probably be the better term of what's going to happen. But just to show you the arrogance, that she fought this, she was convicted. So the guidelines say 18. What is it? 15 to 21 months would be the guideline in her situation. So if they treat her the same as everybody else, she should get anywhere between 15 to 21 months in federal prison. The defense, whenever you go into a sentencing hearing, the prosecution turns in what they feel, and they didn't put any years. They just said, we think it justifies a longer sentence. So they basically kind of hedged their bet and said, well, we're not going to give you how many years we think she should get. We're just going to say that we think because of what she did, she should get a few years or whatever. The defense turned it back, turned in what they thought the sentencing should be, and they said time served. Now, this is what I find interesting about the defense saying, we think you should just go with time served. Judge Dugan never had any time. Normally, when they say time served, it's like, when you're waiting to go to trial, you may spend 6 months, 8 months, or a year in jail waiting trial. And that's what they say. You hear this all the time in state court. We want to give them time served. She never spent one night in jail. So what's time served is zero. So the defense is basically saying, oh, it should be time served. That's zero. So they shouldn't have said time served because there is no time served. She didn't have any time served. So I just find the arrogance still on her side. She needs to go to federal prison. She needs to learn that you cannot skirt the law no matter who you are. So I really found that is really, I'm going to be paying attention on Wednesday, and I think everybody should to see what she actually gets. Now, another one is the Judge Ben's Boasberg on the federal bench. This is obviously an advocate judge, my opinion, who's completely out of control. He's the one who told the Trump administration to facilitate the return of illegal aliens that had been sent out to bring them back. And it's like, what? These people are not citizens of the U.S. The Trump administration has no power in another country. And why, how can you compel the Trump administration to try to cut a deal to let people that are in this country illegally back in to the country? I mean, so this stuff is just crazy. These activist judges who have absolute immunity, and the only way you can get rid of them is impeaching them through Congress, the federal judges. I just don't see that happening. I mean, Congress is so inept. Now, this is what I do see. Last political stuff is you have the fact that they've been going after Trump. And I'll make this prediction because I may not be hosting again until after midterms. If they're probably the Republicans are probably going to lose the House. If they do, Trump will be impeached at least twice in the next 2 years. There's just no doubt about it. They're going to do this. They're just going to absolutely go after Trump. They're so focused on Trump, and they need to forget about Trump. Trump doesn't matter. He's really kind of in a lame duck session. He's only got the 2.5 more years, and he's gone forever. You never have to worry about Trump again from their standpoint. They need to be focused more on J.D. Vance and Rubio, who I think have just been doing a great job for the last 18 months. J.D. is an excellent speaker. I definitely agree with 90% of his views. That's who they should be focusing on. But everybody who's running in the midterms are all focused on Trump. It's like, who cares about Trump? Trump doesn't matter at this point, but they just can't get over Trump. So that's enough of my little political stuff. I see that John has jumped on, and what we were going to talk about, if you could bring him up, wanted to talk about the Nancy Guthrie case. And from my standpoint, for those, I can't imagine there's too many people that are not familiar with this case. This is the one back in Tucson that on February 1st, she was dropped off, I believe, by her son the night before. She goes to church every Sunday. So Sunday morning, she didn't show up for church. So some friends or family went over to the house, couldn't find her in the house, and called police within 5-10 minutes of going through her house. It's the Pima County Sheriff's Office. This is not inside the Tucson city limits. So what you have is out in the county, you have the sheriff. I will tell you, in most areas, I worked for a sheriff in El Paso County. There's about, I believe, last number I heard, about 500,000 people in El Paso County. Predominantly, you know, most of the people are in the Colorado Springs city limits, but there's a lot outside of the city limits. Same thing with Tucson. So the sheriff took over. And this fiasco has been going on for what? 5 months now? And we still have, we're no closer. We don't know where she is. We don't know if she's alive. I mean, odds are obviously not in her favor at this point. And my understanding is the Pima County Sheriff has not given this case over to the feds or to anyone else to look into. And every week or so, we get these new things about there was ransom notes or kidnapping notes, and now they think they're fake. And we have no clue what's going on. I actually think that if you talk about the connection, this is almost looking as bad as the JonBenet case from my standpoint of how when they initiated the case, it's high profile, just like JonBenet, of how they've really just screwed this case up. So John, give me your thoughts on this whole investigation.
I don't even think you could probably consider it an investigation, right? I mean, yes, now the feds are involved. But when you look at it, you know, any investigation, time is of the essence, right? So what we do know is that, you know, again, this is all information from the public domain because you and I aren't privy to the specifics of the investigation. But, you know, what is known is that the son-in-law dropped her off sometime the night of the 31st, around 10 o'clock. And then he leaves and then she doesn't show up to church, like you said. It's reported within like 7-10 minutes after the family gets there to discover that she's not there. And from that point forward, we really have no understanding or idea of what happened to Miss Guthrie. I mean, you know, when you talk about these types of investigations to run kind of a parallel to, you know, things that we've done in the past, you know, law enforcement, I think, number one, I think they lack the experience, which, you know, in these types of cases, experience becomes a critical part of the investigation. You know, I think their lead guy who was a part of this, had maybe 2 years in as a detective. I mean, Mark, you know this. I know this. I mean, 2 years, you're basic, you're barely knowing what's north, south, east, west as far as investigations are concerned, right? You're typically in that time frame of 2 years, you're doing more of the low level follow-up, right? Go talk to this neighbor. Go talk to that neighbor. How about you watch me do this interview? How about you watch, this detective do this, so that they can start to have a better understanding of how investigations are ran. When something like this happens, they may go, look, this is a missing person. Why should we treat it like anything other than that? Right? She could have gone missing. I mean, you got to look at the circumstances of the case. I mean, she was last seen the night before. She's 84 years old. The odds of her getting up in the middle of the night, opening her door and going for a walk in the middle of the night is highly unlikely. Not impossible, but highly unlikely. It's my understanding that, she was on medication. She was not very mobile. So, as an investigator, you got to look at that and go, okay, we really need to pour in the resources, right? The leadership of Pima County should have brought in all of that leadership and advice to say, look, we're not capable of running an investigation involving, a popular, a very popular individual. Her daughter is the popular one, but this can become a very big case. And if you don't take advantage of the resources that are available to you at a local level, a state level, and a federal level, then and do that immediately, then the case starts to go cold. Right. What needs to happen in those initial stages is that it's paramount that you treat it as if something really awful happened. Until you can rule out that something awful did not happen, then you at least are on top of it, and you can see, you can start to conduct a thorough investigation. It's my understanding that a lot of this really didn't begin until days later. And the first 24, 48 hours of an investigation are probably the most critical, the most critical time frame, excuse me, of an investigation. That's when you're deploying every resource, right? We're knocking on doors, we're looking at the digital evidence, we're looking at the forensic evidence, we're looking at possible motives why somebody would want to kidnap, an 84-year-old lady in her own home. Had there been threats in the past? Is there problems with her daughter? Has she done something, or has her son done something? Has her son-in-law done something? Right? You're trying to, right, find all these missing pieces of the puzzle. An investigation like this has thousands of pieces. And so it's very, it's dangerous for you to put somebody who doesn't know how to find those pieces, right? And when you have a 2 year, I won't even say veteran, because veteran is probably not the right word to use. A
Right.
2 year, right? A 2 year old detective. It's like a 2 year old pup or a 2 year old baby. In the fact that you're just barely learning how to walk as a toddler, you essentially are dealing with the same thing as an investigator. You've got to know what needs to be done, and this is not the time to try and give somebody the experience of how to handle a kidnapping, possible homicide. I mean, like you said, right? We're now 5 months into it, over 5 months. I don't think we're any closer than we were in the hours after she went missing. And now we're finding out that a ransom note may have been bogus. We have some ring video, but other than that, I don't think there's been much that has been really disclosed to the public. And here's the other part of it. I can assure you, if there was something significant in identifying a possible suspect, that they would have released something, right? Like, we're looking for, right? They have kind of a profile. I think they said a 5'9", 5'10" guy with a black beard or black mustache, but that's really it, right? I mean, that's what they're dealing with, which is why we are where we are 5 months later. What you hope is that it doesn't end up something like the JonBenet Ramsey case, where it's 30 years later this December, right? It's kind of hard to believe that 30 years later, Mark, we're talking about a case that's still unsolved. hope, you know, we hope that obviously we find Ms. Guthrie, and then we can, in fact, find who's responsible for this, whether it's an individual or a group of people, right? We don't know who's all involved, and we don't really know a whole lot about the investigation. But again, I don't think the leadership within Pima County has set up this individual or individuals within the Pima County Sheriff's Office, meaning the detectives, to be successful. In order for
Right.
them to be successful, right, you reach out to Tucson, you reach out to Phoenix. I can assure you in that area of the country, right, they deal with a lot of kidnappings. Right, you have a lot of things going on with the cartels. You have a lot of things going on with the drug world. Right, you have a major city in Phoenix. You have a major city in Tucson. So you have people that are familiar with these types of cases that know what to do. And you know, of all people, you and I know, right, that digital evidence, right, whether it's a geofence, whether we're talking about, you know, looking at cell tower dumps, whether we're talking about, you know, really anything that can give us some kind of digital footprint of who may be there or may have been there, even in the days prior, right? This just doesn't seem like a off the cuff kind of kidnapping, right? Like, hey,
Right.
it's February 1st, you know, January 31st, which was a Saturday, into February 1st. So you know what? Let's just go see if we can go kidnap an 84-year-old lady, right? There's got to be some canvassing that occurred. There's got to be somebody who had eyes on this particular target, that you know, the Guthrie, Miss Guthrie's home, before they decided that they were going to go and do this. This is not something that, you know, reeks of some kind of just random act, right? Like what you would expect from like a carjacking, you know, of a robbery of somebody, you know, on a corner of a corner store, where it's just kind of this, you know, this in this moment of time, it seems like a crime of opportunity. I think if you look at and dissect this, anybody looking at it with a critical mind would say, you know what? It just doesn't make sense that somebody would have gone in and tried to do this particular night. Let's look at what's going on in the days leading up to it, right? You and I, you know, we deal with cases all the time where we're putting together detailed timelines of what happened before, during, and after the crime, right? So that's what needs to be done. And I don't think that that was done, because if it was done and done properly, we probably would not be talking about this 5 months later as to who possibly did this and whether this ransom note is bogus or not. I mean, to be honest with you, Mark, how do you know if a bogus note, if a ransom note is bogus? Right?
Yeah.
I mean, really, who's applying the science, you know, the medical certainty in this, right? Where you have 90, what, 6% or better chance that this is accurate. Who's looking at a writing and going, this is bogus, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense, which is why, you know, we rely on other evidence, right? You and I talk about aggregate data in the digital world. We're talking about all the evidence in this case, right? What was found at that home, what was left there, and what was taken, you know, other than Miss Guthrie being taken. You know, the killer, if we're talking about killers, or the kidnappers in this case, definitely left behind clues. The question is whether or not law enforcement was smart enough to pick up on those details.
And they definitely, there was such a delay in time. We know they went back to that house multiple times and some others. You know, they never should have released the house. They should have done everything right up front. And if they had any issues, you know, they should have brought in resources to help. I just go back, you know, you and I, you know, John was I think at the point of the Tom Clements, I don't know if you were the
I was the
inspector.
inspector, yeah. I was the inspector,
You
yeah.
ran the investigations before
Right.
you became ultimately the commander. You know, the next morning, so that homicide happened the night before. That next morning, we had a team meeting down at the office, and the largest room we had at headquarters, is that fair
Yeah.
to say? It was
The office of the sheriff, yep, the
it
OTS.
was our training room, and we had everybody in that room. There had to have been at least 40 or 50 people in there from all different agencies, you know, federally. The governor, I think, had a rep there or whatever.
Well,
We had all the
CPI, yeah.
resources that were provided to us. Now, we had the experience. Like I said, I worked for 10 years, about 80 homicides that I worked on. We had more than that. But that we had people who had been there for 20 years working, as detectives, investigators, who had years of experience. So we had the expertise and the knowledge and experience and training to run this, but we still reached out. I remember I worked with an FBI agent, Scott Eicher, on my portion, which was the digital stuff. We worked together on that case. So now we don't know, like we said, we don't know everything that's going on in the background. And I would love for Kash Patel or someone from the FBI to come out and say, we got him. I think that's the only way we're going to ever hear this is that the FBI got him. I think the odds are low. But I will say the one thing. If there's more than one person involved, someone typically talks. I mean, that's just kind of how it works. It may take some time unless you kill the other person, which may have
Loose
happened in the
lips.
JonBenét case.
Yeah,
We
loose
go
lips
back to
and
our
chips.
conspiracy theory there. One of the guys who might have been involved was murdered, and Boulder called it a suicide instead of working a homicide. That another example of Boulder's crappy work. But at this point, I think the only hope is the FBI taking over. But it's so late. I mean, you're so behind the eight ball. They need something to break loose. They're going to need somebody to talk. What happens a lot of times is somebody gets jammed up, that maybe they're not the main player, but one of the subordinate players. They get jammed up in a case and they said, hey, you guys give me immunity and I'll give you the killer, or the kidnapper of Miss Guthrie. That could happen. But they may have already turned on each other and there's only one person left. I mean, you just don't know at this point.
Well, and you're talking about an area of the country at the time in February, right? I mean, Arizona's got cooler weather, but with the summer months and you're talking about 100 plus degree weather, that if she's outside in the elements, her body is decomposing at a much higher rate. So
Right.
if there are any remains, those remains are going to be probably even more difficult to even detect what actually happened to her. So
Right.
you're right. I mean, it's one thing to visit a scene multiple times for the sake of, maybe something you learned in the investigation that causes you pause to go, how can we reconstruct this? But if you're trying to collect evidence after the fact, you went in, you did your search warrant, and you released the scene, and you don't know who's been in that scene after you released it. You're dealing with a lot of unknowns. And so trying to do another search warrant, I have to ask, like, what benefit does that really give you? So,
The defense will fight, will argue over it.
I mean, if they ever identify a suspect, I mean, right now, right? I mean, if you think about it, the most critical thing is trying to find Miss Guthrie, whether she's
Right.
alive or dead, right? That's the most critical piece. Then once we have found her, hoping that she's alive, then it's an idea of, okay, who do we hold responsible for the kidnapping? If she's deceased, then the question is, did she die while she was in, while this kidnapping occurred? Or did she die as a result of somebody shooting her or doing something, heinous to this poor old lady? We don't know. And the more time that goes by, the more we're not going to know because, it's a situation where outside of somebody maybe confessing as to what they did with her,
Right.
it's going to be hard, but it's not impossible. I mean, you get into this line of work hoping that you can find that closure for the family, but the reality is that every hour that goes by, every day that goes by, that case gets colder and colder. People's memories start to fade, evidence starts to get lost, and the only way to build a case is th through evidence. And if you don't have it, and you're trying to look for it 5 months later. I'm not saying it's impossible, but the task becomes that much more difficult. And that's the situation we're in. And I can guarantee you, Mark, if the FBI had any inkling of who did this, positive press, that they're politicians. And
Right.
so anybody would want to let it out that, hey, we've got the person who's responsible for kidnapping and killing Miss Guthrie or kidnapping Miss Guthrie. The fact that, we're hearing crickets in regards to this case. I don't know when's the last time there's been any real formal press release regarding this case, but the reality is, when you don't hear anything, it starts to, out of sight, out of mind. And, from a family perspective, how do you keep it in the limelight so that there's efforts to continue to investigate it, just like it just happened, right? I mean, 5 months later, I can guarantee you the resources that were poured into it in the earlier stages are not being poured into it now, right? They've moved on
Right.
to the next crime. They've moved on to the next thing that has evidence to support, whoever was responsible for that next crime. If they've met a wall where there is no evidence that they've been able to gather more recently, this is unfortunately a case that could potentially be shelved quicker than, than one would want, especially from a family perspective, right? You want this case to be on the radar of for everybody, right? To continue to look for where she is. And the reality is that, the elected, the leadership, they've got new problems and new issues, and their response is going to be that we poured everything into it in the earlier stages and we just don't know what happened. And that's not okay, because if we were to dissect this later, we're going to probably find out that there were a lot of things that were dropped, that a lot of things were not.
Yes. Yep.
They just for some reason thought it wasn't a critical part of the investigation, and here's the reason: because I didn't know better. Right, you can't tell
Right.
me. And this guy could be the sharpest guy, in the toolbox. But the reality is, the only way an investigative agency is good is by the people that work it, not the person, but the people. Right. So that's, as you explain, right? A lot of the detectives in a major agency, whether you're talking about Phoenix or Tucson PD, even the Arizona Department of Public Safety, they've got resources. We did a lot of work with REMIN. I don't know if you remember that, the Rocky
Right.
Mountain Information Network. They've got a fusion center that handles intelligence, and they have the resources to look at things that are going on, right? Did they deploy those resources to find out, look, we can do some things that are thinking outside the box to try and find out where, Miss Guthrie is? But I can assure you, Mark, sometimes our egos get in the way.
Right.
We're our worst enemy. And, as I said, this is no knock on the detective. He's put on in a very precarious position, but you just can't have a person with just a couple years of experience to handle in a major investigation like this. They've got to bring in all the resources to really bring that expertise and that talent into an investigation so that they can, try to develop leads, right? And let those leads hopefully lead to evidence, which will lead to hopefully, some kind of an arrest. Because we do know is it doesn't sound like she left voluntarily, right? I mean, I don't think there's
Right.
any indication that she left voluntarily. I think there's a strong indication based on the Ring video that somebody with a mask was there shortly after the son-in-law dropped her off. And what he or she did, I'm assuming, because they said, a black mustache. I mean, who knows, Mark? I mean, if that's the best information you have to go on, I mean, we all know, right? You can have a mustache today and tomorrow it's gone. A beard today and the next day it's gone, right? We're looking for unique markings. If he had like a tattoo on his face or something, significant that helps us to maybe, look at more of that. More of those features, then maybe we get a little bit closer, right? I think they described his backpack. Okay, so what? It's like
Right.
saying,
How many of
hey, there's
those
a
are
Jan.
sold?
Yeah, it's like saying, hey, there's a JanSport backpack that was found at this school that had something in it. JanSport, like how many kids use
Right.
JanSport, right? I mean, what's the uniqueness of that? Now, if it had some kind of engraved name on it, now we're like, okay, we have some initials, we have a name, we have something, right? But to release something like that, yes, it could be helpful, but if that's what we're solely relying on, the investigation is in trouble. I mean, that's just the
I
bottom
think
line.
it's already it's I think it's been in trouble for a while, and these are the ones that really bother you. And I wonder, what if she wasn't, the daughter or the mother of a famous news broadcaster or whatever? I
Right.
mean, what if she was just some person that disappeared? What urgency? I mean, if this is, they can't work this one.
Right.
with all the resources available to them, whether they're using it or not, what about just an average person? If something happens to them, how much effort is local law enforcement going to put into solving their case?
Right. Like you bring up a good point. Like the only way sometimes that even gets any attention is if like the crime analyst says, "Hey, we've been having a slew of kidnappings of elderly women
Right.
in this area, right?" And now as an investigator, you can start to see where there's a maybe a particular MO.
Pattern.
Pattern, exactly, right? We're looking for whatever that modus operandi is. How did they do it? When did they do it? Was it at night? Was it an individual? Was there ring video? Do they meet the same descriptions, as what we have here with this individual? There's so many things we would look at, but you're spot on, Mark. I mean, it's no different than kid deaths, right? Like, who would have given a bean about a 6-year-old girl dying?
Right.
In a community like Boulder, Colorado, if it wasn't JonBenet, right? I mean, in Denver, I worked a murder of a 6-year-old little girl, Ashley Gray, who was raped and sodomized by a guy by the name of Morris. And you would have asked yourself there, like, why didn't she get the attention that JonBenet Ramsey got? Right? I mean, you know it. Why does Tom Clement's death make headlines more than, other people that have been murdered in their homes or, near their homes? It's just it's unfair. And what we know is that if you had poured the resources into every one of those, we might have a better clearance rate. But I think what Puma had 6 murders the year before. I mean, 6 murders, right? I mean, I guarantee you Tucson had much more. I guarantee you that Phoenix had much more. I guarantee you that, with that, they have experience of, and you can create a task force, right? You bring in a couple people, you ask the sheriff
Right.
to ask their chief to say, "Hey, can you have one of your detectives come and work with us until we can try, until we find somebody who's responsible for this?" So they do it all the time. They did it in up in Washington when what are they, the Green River
Green
Killer.
River Killer,
Yeah,
yep.
right. I mean, you look at these kinds of cases, they deploy resources. It's not for a lack of resources. It's not like you and I, where
Right.
we're going up against the government in a case where,
Right.
they have unlimited resources, right? We're being asked to look at a case where, they got 10, 11 detectives working it, and you or I are asked to look at it and go, "Can you make heads or tails of this investigation and
Right.
do it within 50 hours?"
Right.
When they're
Because we
wasting
don't have
hundreds of
unlimited
thousands,
money.
right? Because they have hundreds of or thousands of hours to go in and investigate something, and then,
Right.
"Hey, Mark, here's a case. Can you look at it and tell us what your thoughts are on it? But oh, by the way, can you kind of limit your time on it because we
We
don't
don't
really
have
have the
funding.
resources?" That's right.
And
Right.
I actually said that in court just a couple of weeks ago when I was testifying. The prosecution was trying to make a big deal about how much I charge and all this other stuff. And they basically said, since 2016, you've never testified for the prosecution, have you? And basically my response was, yeah, and there's a reason for that. And then when I was asked, well, what is the reason? It's because I cost money.
Right.
Prosecution has all these free experts, FBI, ATF, CBI,
Sure.
local
DEA,
detectives.
Secret Service, local
Doesn't
detective.
cost them a dime. I mean,
Does
so you're
not.
talking the true David versus Goliath scenario
Right.
where we're trying to equalize with our
Playing
one
field.
person.
Right. Equalize the playing field. Exactly.
Yeah, and that's a huge burden, but yet we have been somewhat successful, and I wouldn't even say somewhat. We've been pretty much successful on the cases where we found issues that we have been able to step up and make a difference in some of these cases and get more favorable outcomes. But yeah, I just feel for, like in this situation, they should put a task force together at this point. The more people you put in a room and just get provide them with the evidence, provide them with the facts of the case,
Right.
you have that many more opportunity for someone to say, you know what, 6 years ago I saw this or
That's
did
right.
this or
That's right.
whatever.
That's
Or,
right.
that kind of fits a guy that I investigated up in Phoenix 3 years ago. You never know. So the more people you can put in a room and
Right.
say, we just want you to, let's discuss. have a little what do they call that? Brainstorming session. Bring in the FBI, ATF, bring everybody in, that might help, and
Well,
have a
yeah.
conversation and see if anyone might think of something. But a lot of it goes strictly to arrogance. And I saw this. So as a detective for 10 years, I felt I was about in the middle. I wasn't at the point that I was like, I'm an expert, detective, but I wasn't a baby ex, detective. So at 10 years, I felt comfortable. That's how long it takes to get to the point where you feel comfortable. 20 years is when you're going to say, I'm a master detective or whatever, if you're good at it, some aren't.
Right.
But
And it really depends on the types of cases you worked, right? I mean,
exactly, your experience.
some individuals are really good about property crime and some are really good about sexual assaults, right? And then you have those that have dedicated a lot of their time into, attempted murders and murder cases. And the problem in these cases, Mark, is every one of them is a little different. So to say
Right.
that you're a master of homicide,
That
you
would
may
be a
understand.
fallacy.
Yeah, right. You may understand the process. You may understand some of the things that have worked, but I can tell you this, a cop that's 20-year veteran or more, they're not utilizing technology like you and I are using
Right. That is
technology,
true.
right? So they're relying on a lot of old school methodologies. And if you don't, continue to learn and continue to challenge yourself as to what those new things are that are today, and you're kind of oblivious to it, like how do you get better, right? And so there's a danger in saying, hey, I've done this for 20 or 30 years, if
Right.
you're not in tune with the way cases are working today. And you and I know, right, because we work cases every day, that there's all kinds of new things that are being developed today, right, that were not around back in our time when we were doing homicides. Yes, that there's some technology that still exists like DNA, but guess what? DNA has been totally changed as well. The way they use DNA in the 90s, early 90s, to the way they're using it 35, 40 years later, 30, 35 years later, guess what? 36 years later, it's completely different, right? You can get
Right.
DNA now from things that never people never met could imagine,
Skin.
right?
Skin cells.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things, and especially in our world with digital technology, people don't understand that, man, our phones have more
Oh.
on there than anybody can re I mean, for you and I, the phone is it. Like, give me the
It's the
phone in
wealth
hand.
of information. I call it
Right.
the modern day DNA
Yep.
because it has the ability to solve so many cases. And as a there's a term that they say, a lifelong learner is an individual that always wants to be learning new stuff. And anybody who is a true learner understands that the more that they know, the more they don't know,
That's
and the
right.
more they need to know. And
That's right.
so if you ever hear, I know everything
Yeah,
about
you got to be conscious
homicides,
about
or
that. Yeah.
you got to be very
Well,
cautious because you don't know it all. You never will,
right. I mean, we
because
did think about it, right? Why do you and I teach? Right? We
right.
both teach at a higher, a higher level of education. And why do we do it? Because that constant teaching challenges us because, there's new things that come out every day. And where do you typically see that? You see that in the educational system,
In the
right?
classroom.
In the
And
classroom.
I definitely encourage my students constantly to challenge me.
Right.
I tell them, look, if you want to have a debate, this is going to be a safe zone. We can have a great debate. And if you hear, and I think numerous times a student brought something up and said, what about this? And I'm going, what is that?
Right.
And it's something new. At some point, we had to hear about TikTok for the first time. Now, I don't know when that was. At
Right.
some point, hey, have you heard this new thing called TikTok? And I'd be like, I don't know what TikTok is, but you go find out and then you learn more, you get more experience.
Sure.
And so I definitely
Snapchat,
encourage that. And I
Instagram.
think that really does help us. Being in the classroom, I'm teaching tomorrow night, is constantly learning new stuff. And it's the young people, the new students, the new edu you know, the ones getting the education that
Right.
know this new stuff, especially about technology.
Oh,
I'll
yeah.
tell you, my kids know more than I do, and they constantly tell me about stuff. Hey, Dad, you know about this?
Right.
I'll never forget, I tell the story. I wanted to keep my son entertained or busy for the whole summer, So I bought all these pieces to a computer, and I did this on purpose. I mean, I bought the cabinet, the CPU, the motherboard, bought all this separately. And I gave it to him in a package, all brand new equipment, and said, spend the summer building a computer. It was up and running the next day. It's like, now what do we do for the rest of the summer? So these kids know so much more than we do. And I love being in a teaching environment. I just realized that I've been teaching for 21 years at Pikes Peak, and I love it.
I'm in the same boat, right? I mean, and the other thing that we're constantly doing is we're teaching juries. You know, not only are we teaching students, we teach juries, right? We get a lot of our information on how cases are developed from us reading through and understanding also how these cases were developed, right? Like you said, whether it's a case that the FBI helped a local agency analyze or whatever it may be, right? That's what keeps us also updated. So there's so many things that are constantly evolving in the world of, the criminal justice system. And no, not one person can know everything, but I'll tell you, in the position that you and I have been in, in the last 5, 10 years, we're having to know a lot of different disciplines and understand how that's being used to convict somebody, of a potential crime. And so what a better learning experience for you and I, right? To know like, hey, this is how they're weaponizing DNA now. This is how they're using, the Pharo system to reconstruct a crime scene, right? I mean, yes, I can still reconstruct a crime scene old school way, but now a lot of things are automated, right? I mean, you and I just did a homicide case in a, up in the Adams County area, and they used a Pharo system, but the person using the Pharo never explained what the measurements were. So, I mean,
And
how
they
does that
weren't, I
happen?
don't think they were qualified or
That's
trained on the
right.
device
That's right.
adequately. And I'll say this for, I mean, who knows how long I'll keep saying this. Definitely local law enforcement has not received proper training on how to do a thorough digital investigation. They are taking shortcuts, they're overstating the facts from the standpoint of trying to use technology to say they were there. And you can't do it. Definitely with like cell phone records and stuff, constantly, probably once a month, I'll read a report where they just say straight up, the cell phone records indicated that they were at or near the location of the shooting. It's like, you can't say that.
Well, Mark, I mean, you just did a case. It's not just the local level. Think about the
Oh, the.
FBI, analyzing a piece of digital evidence and saying, we don't need to collect that, right? We're just going to go to our car,
Oh,
do an
yeah.
extraction, and then give it back. Like, wait, what? What did you just do? So,
Ignoring best
that's
practices.
right. And so that
And
digital evidence, like you said, a true digital forensic investigation, a lot, not just at the state level, the local level, it's happening also on the federal level.
it is. That's a great point, is even with the FBI, and I've seen testimony with the FBI where they've made statements that's just not true. And I've been trying to get to them to say, guys, you need to sit down with me. I'll be more than happy to explain to you why you're wrong on this point. And I know they're still teaching this. It has to do with the speed of light and timing advance records with CDRs. They're making a statement that the cell phone has to be inside this arc. Don't want to go into too much details right at the end. And I can prove on a case up in Denver where we know where the cell phone was located, and it was definitely outside the arc. So their statement, that they're saying in in court, testimonies, hearings, trials, that the cell phone had to be inside that arc are absolutely wrong, and I can prove them wrong, and would love to explain it to them how they're wrong. But sooner or later, our paths will cross in the courtroom, and I will lay out how I know that what they're saying is not true.
Well, and the problem with that too, Mark, I mean, not to, to bore the listeners with this, but these technologies were never designed to be used in an investigation.
That is exactly right, which is the main
So,
point. These are engineering records that the cell phone providers are using for capacity planning and network design, And the government's trying to use it to get precise locations of where the cell phone is. It was never intended to do that. It's not GPS. And they're trying to play that game. And if there's nobody to go in there and say, hey,
Time
what you're
out.
saying is wrong, the jury's only hearing one side of the story and they're going with it. So
That's it. You get
maybe
it.
that's something for another day to talk about.
Absolutely.
I've had some great federal cases up in Anchorage. I had a whole case thrown out because they searched a cell phone without a warrant and I could prove it. They were trying at first to argue that, oh no, we didn't search it, and then I proved it. And they said, well, it looks like maybe it was searched early, but not by me. So everybody kept saying that, hey, it wasn't me. So we never know who actually did it. But the federal judge said, yeah, that was pretty compelling testimony. It's pretty obvious you guys violated the Constitution. You searched something without a search warrant, and you had no exigent circumstances or anything to justify that warrantless search. So that was pretty awesome. So I think we've used up all our time. So I don't know what we'll talk about next time. It may be a few months before I get an opportunity to guest host again. Always love to watch Chuck and Julie. They keep me updated on all the local state politics, and I love listening to them. And I appreciate them letting me come here and talk. John, thank you for coming out and making this entertaining, because I can't do it on my own. And
My
maybe
pleasure.
we'll
Thank
find
you.
another case. One of those, we're always working interesting cases, and we keep hoping for them to end so we can talk about them. So maybe we will talk about some of these federal cases I've worked on in the last year or two. But
Sounds good.
everybody have a great week. I think Chuck and Julie will be back next week. And catch everybody later.